Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast where we discuss classic works of management and organization studies. We continue episode 59, where we are discussing Douglas McGregor's classic book, The Human Side of Enterprise, originally published in 1960. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is part two of the episode, which we've subtitled, Does Theory Y Really Work? And is Theory X Really All That Bad? We now rejoin the conversation. Now, as we talked about McGregor's book in the first part, and one of the images that I have going through my mind were various scenes from an episode we did not too long ago, and this was on Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. And the reason why this comes into mind is that if you want to come up with a perfect satire for Theory X, you know, that's about it. And it's, I'm not going to get into the particular scenes, but let me just kind of think about some of the things that just sort of exemplify Theory X. And I want to try to get into, you know, why is Theory X so attractive? Why does it perpetuate so much? And there are a couple of things from that movie that just sort of exemplify that for me, such as just the callous attitude of the manager, who is a different social class from the workers and who has no connection to the workers, or who looks at the workers as little more than human resources. So there's that. And then there's also the scene in which the Chaplin character basically – he finds out that three positions are opening up in a factory, and you've got like 2,000 people crashing the gate trying to get into the factory to get those three positions. He dances through the crowd and magically becomes one of the three. Just the idea of the fixed boundary of the organization, which basically assumes that you have to have a certain number of people. Again, it's sort of like, you know, reducing people to a number. And so then all of the talk about when we change organizations come down to a numbers game, whether the numbers is the physical number of people that we want in the organization, or what we consider to be the proper for, you know, filling out the functions, or the money. I mean, certainly money decisions come into play. If, you know, fixed budgets, it says that we're going to allocate this much to people, then, okay, how much is a person worth? Which is, to me, a very Theory X kind of a question. And then there's the, as I alluded to in part one, there's the external factors of pressures being placed on the organization, especially competitive pressures, where organizations are comparing themselves to each other through, again, quantitative metrics. The bottom line, or customer share, or whatever metric that they use, all of it just sort of diminishes the idea of what the human is worth in an organization. And because competitive pressures are persistent, it just seems to be like Theory X is what we almost default to, because it's the only way we can deal with a quantification of these sorts of things.
But that's a great point. This idea that there's emphasis on quantification. There's many people that argue that the MBA programs in the United States and in the West are very deficient because of this tendency to, like you said, Tom, treat the humans as just replaceable machine parts, and that the real meat of an organization is in its strategy and the products it produces and those kind of things, which, oh, by the way, are done with people. And so I think there's a couple trends like that. One is this idea of the quantification of lots of aspects of business. And McGregor talks about this idea that maybe some things can't be quantified or not easy to quantify, so they don't lend themselves really well to appraisal, whether it's performance or outcomes or anything else, strictly by the numbers. I've worked a lot in engineering and technical organizations, and I have noticed this general attitude or approach that never really got people to articulate their assumptions, but you might be able to infer them, is that with engineers and a lot of technical organizations, in them, the people are this messy, unpredictable aspect of the work, right? They're not like the physics. They're not like the irrigation canal to water the fields. And so what I've seen a lot in the past is engineers will write procedures to try to remove the people or remove discretion of the people, and not necessarily because they had these direct Theory X assumptions, but that, in engineering terms, a lot of engineers seem to believe that, oh my gosh, all the source of variability is people. If I could do something about the people and make them conform to the machine behavior, a la Modern Times and other similar satires. I was thinking when you were talking about Modern Times, the little snippet version of that is the Lucy show, I Love Lucy show, where she's on some factory line making chocolate.
A classic scene there.
And the line goes too fast for her. Yeah, and it's very short, but it's also this, like, the boss doesn't care, gives you a couple of rules, and out they go, and basically she becomes a slave to the conveyor belt, right? Which is there's a lot of truth to stuff like that, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why Modern Times was so successful in its day, is it was a satire, but a satire based on truth. That wasn't an illusion or a fantasy world. That was a lot about what real work was like, perhaps taken to an extreme. And so I think that a lot of people in today's technical organizations would be appalled if you said, well, you know, you're a Theory X type, or this looks very Theory X, and would argue with you. No, I think people are motivated and have all these other kinds of things, but they do cause a lot of variability that I'm trying to eliminate. And so instead of rethinking the procedures, we try to more and more narrowly constrain performance, which in my view, and a lot of views of safety, is a self-defeating approach.
We might not be enamored with Theory X now. However, could one make an argument that there's a little bit of Theory X assumptions built into the move to things like algorithmic management and the gig economy? And the reason why I ask that is because, you know, on the one hand, in McGregor's book, he looks at control a certain way, you know, basically control over humans. And in a way, I'm thinking that the algorithmic management circle is control of a different fashion, where instead of having increased control over one's environment, which includes the people, you simply control the environment through contracting. You basically don't worry. You just throw the risk away. You see what I mean?
Oh, that's excellent. Yes, you outsource it, right? So a couple of examples come to mind. One is, there's an HR program for selecting people because it's getting a lot of radio advertising in the United States. I don't remember the name of it, and that's not important. But essentially, they're talking about, oh, we have all this variability and it's so hard to get the right candidate. And you could just turn all this stuff over to a machine and algorithms and keywords, and your day will be wonderfully better because you'll just find all these perfectly suited people. And it makes me think of McGregor's admonition in this middle part of the book, that you could have people with different backgrounds and they could take different approaches to the jobs and they could be equally successful. You don't need a carbon stamp or carbon clone stamp that says, okay, they all need to have these all features and this all this background and everything. And in fact, we talk about diversity and management approaches. We find is very helpful in organizations. And then the second thing that came to mind when you were talking about that was I recently attended the Organizational Learning, Knowledge, and Capabilities Conference in Brighton with you, Tom. And you remember at one of those, it wasn't really a keynote, it was a discussion between those two gentlemen, I forget their backgrounds, one was in the arts and one was somebody else. One of the persons was decrying algorithmic management, and the other person says, well, you know that, yes, algorithms are opaque and they have these biases of the programmers built in and they have these difficulties, but he said, in almost every case, it makes better decisions than the humans did. And so he seemed to be suggesting, oh, we just need to make the algorithms better, as opposed to, well, wait a minute now, there's really, you really want to inject the humans into the process more. I mean, I'm probably putting words in his mouth, but there was that conversation about that I thought was very interesting. It's very timely.
If I could add as well that I think there are a lot of organizations out there, and what I've studied the most are what would be described, I guess, as tech, which would describe themselves very much as Theory Y organizations, and on the surface of it would appear to tick all those boxes. But the control that's used in the organizations is more Theory X, but it's manifest more as normative control or concertive control. There's almost a facade of Theory Y. And I think people do revert to Theory X. And as I was reading the book and scribbling my notes as well, I think that to some extent, just because that's the way it's always been, a lot of organizations are created with Theory X in mind because it's what we know the most. We always revert to it, arguably, you know, maybe it works to some extent as well. And I think Theory Y is great, and it is something that I think we all try and aspire to. And it's great when things are going well, but my experience of the being in organizations with Theory Y influencing how the organization is run and its managerial style is that when things go wrong, that's when you run into trouble, and people will always revert to Theory X when things go wrong. Open to debate on that.
Well, that's actually a good point. And one argument might be made that that's normal and expected, that when things are going wrong, you want to exert more control. The real issue, I think, is for how long?
Yeah.
And in what forms, right? Because if you say, oh, well, we were doing all these Theory X or Theory Y approaches, and it's really not worked, and we're just going to do all Theory X, McGregor and I would argue that's not a good approach. You're really going to be hard, particularly in the industries that you've looked at or sectors you've looked at, Catherine.
Yeah.
Of taking that kind of hands-on, largely controlling and directive approach. And so if they switch back or gently release the controls or whatever language you want to use, maybe that's not so bad. You hit on something I thought was really interesting, is that in many ways, and we talked about this in part one, in many ways, Theory X, it's comfortable. It's a little bit easier to do. It's kind of simple. By that, I mean cognitively simpler. And so I could see people deriving some comfort from that, because there's quite a few expectations on managers in Theory Y, or that stem from Theory Y, that are not easy to do. It's a very high bar.
And as you say, people are messy and complex as well. So it's sometimes easier to simplify.
Oh, yes.
And less time consuming and cost less money.
Yeah, and that's an important point about the time and money. The one of the things, and I think there's a cultural factor that we ought to bring into this, that it's the culture of, or the propensity for action. Obviously, we in the West have a far greater propensity for action built into culture in various ways. And so then, you know, even whether things are going down or whether they're looking up, there's still a desire to, you know, to demonstrate one's strengths, or to show that one is competing well within the within the competitive environment. And that generally puts you in a position of Theory X, because when you're competing, it doesn't take very much for the opponents to find something to nit, well, basically to criticize or nitpick at. And so, you know, we think about the organization, of course, being made of humans who are messy. The moment that somebody makes a mistake or misspeaks or misrepresents the organization in some way, tweets something reprehensible, you know, whatever it is, then it enables the opponent. So what's the natural reaction to that? Is to find interesting reasons for exercising greater control over what the organization does or how it interacts in the external environment. So it doesn't even have to be when it's bad. It could be when it's going well. Folks are afraid to have somebody in the organization go rogue and screw it up. I don't know how you negate that. That's hard.
Well, I think that's an interesting. It's a really good observation about the role culture could play, and from the way you described it, I think you were talking about two cultures. See if I get this right. You're talking about the culture within the organization, right? Where if the organization has this bias for action, which is typically what you would see in manufacturing or possibly companies that sell some product to the consumers, where the cycle time is very short and you have to innovate very, very quickly. So there's this premium placed on action. And it's not easy to do rapid action under Theory Y assumptions. And so I could see that kind of bias, because you often, I never saw anybody in the Navy get rewarded for stopping to think about a problem.
True statement.
Or consulting their subordinates, right? Which is what I often want to do. And so there's one aspect to it. And then I think you hit on a really interesting part, which is this Western versus perhaps Eastern or other cultures approach to work and change. And that we also have this bias for action and standing out and demonstrating leadership and leading the pack in the West, whereas one of the stereotypes, but perhaps it's not it's not a pure stereotype, is that in the Eastern cultures, they focus a lot more on getting the questions right, making sure you're asking the right kinds of questions before you actually try to jump in and solve the problem. And Toyota and some of the other dominant Japanese manufacturers are not bad examples of that. And then I was at a presentation at the University Forum for HRD this past summer, and we had a Palestinian scholar was talking about how Palestinian women are treated in the workforce and how they fulfill family obligations and roles. And, you know, what we would do, and even in Western countries that are in Palestinian areas, and he was describing some issues or general policies where the Western tendency is, well, we're just going to put a policy up. We're just going to tell people what to do. And he was suggesting that doesn't work, because in those kinds of cultures, Arabic cultures, family and family connections are really, really important. And so it's a mistake for an organization to say, well, okay, we have these, even if it's theory Y kind of stuff, if you don't include the connections to the person's community and how they see their place in the community, you're making a mistake, and you're actually potentially damaging people or putting them at risk in their community. I don't mean life and limb kind of risk, but basically esteem and connection with their families, which are very, very important.
Oh, yeah. Honor. I mean, the whole conception of honor and shame is very, very important in many cultures around the world. But the cultures of which we're talking about, you know, that he's talking about in the book, honor and shame is a whole different thing.
I just thought it was really interesting that you mentioned the C word, culture, because I don't think it's mentioned at all in the book. And that's possibly because of when it was written as well, that probably came in the 1970s and afterwards, that it was kind of recognized, even though people were aware of what it was, but it wasn't given that name, because culture obviously is key with theory X and theory Y.
I think you're right that many times we'll look at something written, you know, decades ago on the podcast, and we have to remind ourselves, okay, but that they're describing the world in which they lived, and in McGregor's case, the world in which he wants to live, or what these implications are. And I think we do have to be more understanding of, well, what do they think about at the time, or what was life like at the time? Just like Taylor, it's easy to look back at Taylor and say, he's an idiot. He had this machine idea of organizations and was treating people like machines. And yet you have to read a bit more to understand, no, he cared about more than that. And he actually did have the welfare of the workers at heart, but he had a certain view of the world that was common in those days. And the workforce they were dealing with was of a particular nature, and it's evolved. And I think that's one of the interesting things. So one of the things I thought several times while I was reading the book is there are many places where it's more philosophy or vision than it is really something based on sound principles. And I'm not saying that's bad. I do think he lays out a compelling vision, and he really does a good job of integrating all the parts. What I wonder about management scholarship and organizational studies is, even in this annotated edition, why don't you see more research that's done on these things that essentially McGregor was guessing about or forecasting and saying, well, we have some data, but it's kind of tentative, and we think the general trends are this. And even McGregor says, and more research could be done. And you don't see as much of that in the annotated edition, or even in my personal experience, where there's a lot of research that says, yeah, here's how you balance these things, or there's some. I mean, I think that would be a fertile area for listeners of our podcast in organizational science in general, is to take a book like this, and McGregor's is just one example, and look at these things that they're forecasting or saying, oh, okay, we don't have a lot of data, this is what we think. Go collect some data. Let's go see how that's working out. And I think the risk of sounding a little bit too critical, I think a lot of our current scholarship is going into micro and teeny tiny details of these individual relationships and what people, bosses and subordinates care about. And hey, step back a little bit and look at some more of these assumptions that underpin theory Y, and a little bit about when they do and do not apply. I mean, I think Catherine had a great example. McGregor talks about the balance, and Catherine said, and particularly when a company is retrenching, which does happen in business, not everybody has upward rising sales forever. And what is the tendency, and how do they go about doing that? And does that mean you've just thrown theory Y out the window, or is it a temporary measure, or is it help you get better control, or, you know, those kinds of things? I think that would be really interesting research.
I think one of the challenges that I have in general, though, is okay, how do you actually build an organization so that it can be sufficiently free of Theory X influences, or at least the wrong Theory X influences, so you can actually study it to see just how well, how much better it performs, whatever we mean by perform, which is another challenge. Let's say if you wanted to build an industry that's built exclusively free of Theory X influence, that would be hard to do because it would still have to compete. And the competition, and it's not even just national competition, it's now multinational competition, global competition, are operating under various rules that govern how you measure yourself and how you measure performance and what you, you know, how you measure everything. What you could bring where you maximize the Theory Y influences and try to measure, you know, just sort of like what happens. But instead, I think what we probably see are, you know, taking certain facets that have a strong Theory X influence and contrasted with something. Like, for example, what comes to mind is the episode we did some time back on the emotional labor. That was Hochschild, I believe, right?
Yeah, Hochschild. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, the managed heart. Yep.
The managed heart. Yeah, that's the one. And that to me is an example of perhaps how, you know, we're trying to quantify emotion. And I read a lot of Theory X into that, you know, in thinking about that in retrospect. So then, you know, a lot of what she was recommending that we should do instead seemed to have aligned very much with McGregor's Theory Y. So there you're just taking like one facet of the organization's behavior and trying to say, okay, how do things improve if we try to push aside the you know, sort of the facade of emotional labor and try to make it more authentic or more genuine, a little bit more of a connection? Does that actually improve performance? I don't remember if that question was actually answered. I think it was just raised in that particular book.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, and so the model, if you continue with the idea of the flight attendants that Hochschild looked at, and that they had a very particular model back in those days when she wrote the book, and then you see that some organizations today, Southwest Airlines being a particularly good example, you know, they're going to the model of giving the employees more flexibility, giving them more capability to express themselves, and giving them more options for figuring out how to contribute to the organization that are quite a bit different. However, there are aspects of the competitive landscape that People Express or Southwest Airlines, they, you know, they differ strongly from the big mainline carriers that enables some of that kind of thing. So there's aspects, and I think Catherine hit on this earlier, this complexity of the work environment and the business environment and the competitors and those kinds of things. And not only that, there's also just the structure of the enterprise and how large it is. There are many times when I was thinking during the reading that it would be interesting to do research between and compare big and small companies, because a lot of what this customization and really attention to the emotional and motivational needs of employees is, I think, easier to do in small groups. And I've been in small organizations and big organizations, and your ability to customize and provide people options and discretions are quite a bit different between those two kinds of organizations, because just the you know, the numbers of people you're dealing with and the what I think the author called the milieu in which it operates, all of those things are really important. And so I think they temper how well you can practice Theory X and Theory Y, or how you balance them, I think.
Yeah, that's the size of the organization does seem to strike me as an interesting factor in this, because when we think about when we buy stuff from a small organization, a small company, we sort of have this vision of the company being perhaps more flexible, more innovative, or more intimate. Like if you're buying a local brand of something as opposed to something like a store brand or a brand name brand from a grocery or a department store. Whereas like with the larger organizations, what are you thinking about? You're thinking about if I'm going to go to have dinner in a chain restaurant in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and I'm going to go out to Montana and I'm going to go to the same chain, you almost expect the same experience, right?
Yeah, but don't count on it.
Well, okay, perhaps not, but you understand what I mean is that
there's
certain things you might allow variance for, but ultimately you expect something to be the same.
Right, homogeneity,
and
I would say.
So, yeah, homogeneity, that's a good way to put it. What does that drive you towards? If you're thinking strategically at the, this large firm, what are you thinking of? You're thinking of how do you ensure calibration across all of the possible outlets that you have. And yeah, in that sort of a situation, it's hard not to default into theory X, even though you are really wanting to push for some of the benefits of empowerment and, perhaps give some autonomy to your franchises or do these other things that try to make things a bit more participative. Ultimately, you're going to be measured by how well calibrated your experience is where customers go, no matter where your services are provided.
That's a really interesting idea. This, I think you've hit on something important, Tom, and that is this scale aspect of it. So in the larger organizations, you're looking for predictability, repeatability, homogeneity. I mean, in good ways, right? I mean, there's times that you don't want that. But really, it's very, very important for large organizations to be consistent. And so there are aspects where you can't afford or don't have the time, or there's lots of other reasons to provide all this customization. So there's aspects of the business that really do have to be perhaps theory X because of the scale. And that's kind of an interesting idea. How would you research that? How would you look at bigger and larger organizations? And I've been in organizations where the culture is, okay, well, I'll just wait to be told what to do. And it used to frustrate me. And then I realized, well, perhaps these people have the experience of getting burned by doing that or trying to do something differently and getting negative consequences, or that the stick part of the carrot stick combination. And perhaps it wasn't just me saying, oh, they don't want to work. It's they've had some experience in the culture, and because of the nature of the work they do, that they can't afford to be quite so theory-wise. I mean, maybe that's not the best way to say it, but that's what it makes me think of.
I think as well, in some organizations, large and small, in various contexts within teams, it can vary. So there may be an overarching Theory X organization, but within certain teams and certain functions, it can be led or managed in slightly more of a Theory Y style. It doesn't mean the organization isn't successful or performance, however that's measured, is affected by that. But that little subcultures of Y, for example, in a Theory X organization can appear and not necessarily negatively, or a Theory Y organization might have aspects of it or teams within it that are a little bit more Theory X than others and can sit along nicely. Because I think there's an element of idealism that everything can perfectly align to Theory X or Theory Y. And sometimes, as you've both said previously as well, things are a little bit more messy and complex because it involves human beings.
Well, I think that's a really interesting insight. I was thinking about it, but I didn't say it. So, you get the points there. And that is, I think people shouldn't get demotivated if they say, well, I'm in a Theory X organization and we have to do these kinds of things, because I think a lot of people externally imagine the military as being very Theory X and top-down driven and such, and it really isn't. And one of the, I think, interesting observations is, it was one of the secretaries of the Navy under, I think it was the during President Clinton's term, and his name escapes me at the moment. He looked around a lot of things that he saw going on in the Navy, and he says, you guys are still operating with what he called a conscript mentality, right? So you hear that, and you say, well, what do you mean by that? And it was a lot of this Theory X stuff, acting as if your sailors were conscripted in the military and had no choice. And he says, that's not the way it works. He said, they have a choice. They can leave. And you'll be on your knees in a few years if you don't have sufficient levels of retention of employees. So you need to rethink. You still have some vestiges of this old way of thinking, very, very Theory X. And he said, you need to be rethinking how to value the contribution and match the the motivational needs of the employees to the, or the sailors and personnel, including the civilians, to the organizational needs. And he didn't use those terms, but that's really what he was talking about. So it's interesting how these things that seemed so revolutionary back in the 1960s, and indeed they were, have crept into our modern language, and we often don't acknowledge the roots of this in McGregor. Maybe he doesn't get all the credit, but I think that's really where the Secretary of the Navy was coming from.
And perhaps he's one of the first to acknowledge, even though he hasn't explicitly said it, that employees are a source of competitive advantage. I think you mentioned that in your introduction, Ralph, as well. I think in the editor's note as well, it poses the question, are people the engine that creates value or a cost to cut wherever possible? And I think that's true to this day.
Well, it's especially true when we think about the degree to which we're now making decisions as to whether we're going to use humans or robots. And that was one of the things that was crossing my mind, especially, you know, whether it's military organizations, whether it's industry, whether it's, you know, the desire to try to achieve, in effect, savings by using automation or using apps or using robots to try to cut down on the, you know, the messiness of hiring or having humans and replacing them with robots. It sort of leads me in a different direction in terms of what do we mean by theory X and theory Y in those regards, because if you do start to take away the human element of organizations, is there something lost in the pursuit of efficiency? I think the jury is still out as to whether or not robots are actually more efficient than humans. They may be inefficient in ways we haven't figured out yet.
Well, I think another way to look at that, which I think you started out of a good path, is not only at the individual level, are the robots more or less efficient than humans, or what kind of support do they need? Because they always need support. There's this other aspect to the nature of work, and whether it's robots or algorithms, and they share a lot of similarities in how they function autonomously without direct human intervention, is that how it affects the nature of the other work that has to be done, right? Certainly you have people that have to go maintain the robots and do certain things, and they're not necessarily line employees, and so the line employees that they replace don't have the skills necessarily, unless the organization makes a lot of effort to retrain them to maintain or program or do what have you with the robots. And the darker side of algorithms is, okay, sure, you remove a lot of this human variability and you get a lot of predictability, yes, but as that they noted at the Organizational Learning and Knowledge Capabilities Conference, it also introduces opacity. If Tom's on the assembly line and he's having to stuff chocolates in his mouth because the line's going too fast, I can see that, right? Or I might be able to see some evidence of that. One wonders, and you hear a lot of these kind of interesting problems that come up with the biases of the algorithms, which certainly exist, are not nearly as visible or obvious, except for maybe when you look at some of the outcomes. And then, well, what button do you push, right? I can't just slow down the assembly line if I think the algorithm or the robot is not functioning well. And then the third aspect it makes me think about is in safety. This comes up a lot. They talk about how we'll take all these complicated tasks and we'll automate them, and whether it's flight navigation computers or landing gear, you know, those kinds of things, and at the risk of significantly increasing the complexity of what the humans have to do. So we say, oh, this is kind of hard to program, so we'll just have Ralph do that. and it's not so easy for Ralph to do either. And they took away the job I might have used to help me build the expertise to do this function. And so I think Tom had a really good point there in this nature of algorithms and robots and making certain aspects of the job more automatic. It has strengths and weaknesses, and they're not easy to predict, because if you just go down the path of saying, well, it's cheaper, I can do this for less expensive, and I'm engineering humans out, I don't think you're seeing the whole picture.
And people tend to assume that that robots do not become more expensive. I mean, there's a cycle there.
And they do, and they need to be replaced, yeah, too. And oftentimes the software has to be upgraded. I remember we didn't, this wasn't robots, but we were in a large organization and we completely changed how we wrote the work instructions and created this huge integrated system and spent a bunch of money and to do this in the programs and buy the hardware and all sorts of stuff because it was Unix based, so none of the desktop hardware would run it, and probably none of the desktop hardware we had at the time was powerful enough to run this stuff because it was enormous databases, Oracle databases. And then about 3 years into it, the people who were managing the program went to the financial people and said, okay, now we need to start programming for the replacement. And they said, what? We just bought all this stuff. And to them, the financial people, it was absolute heresy and craziness to talk about we had bought these things and they needed to be replaced over time. That, it wasn't a one-time cost. And I think now people understand, we talk about this in the Navy, and I know the Army does too. We talk about refreshing the technology, right? It's not good enough to have this great solution and then it's going to just stay fixed for 10 years and you're all set. No, it wears out. It becomes obsolete. You can't get parts. The software changes. And so there's all these other kinds of aspects about this where, it's not a panacea. Robots are a challenge.
So I think it's about time for us to wrap. I think for my last word, I'd like to just sort of piggyback on what you said there, Ralph, and say, so on the one hand, McGregor introduced us to the nature of the human side of enterprise. There's something to be said about, keeping the human in the human side of enterprise.
I think, this book is a fantastic classic of organizational behavior. It's very important text. I'm really glad that I got an opportunity to read the actual text as well. Some academics have discussed since the polarizing forces of theory X and Y. I think Blake and Morton did. And Drucker certainly talked about the sham battle that occurs every day between theory X and theory Y. And I think that probably is more representative of daily life in most organizations, even if they are theory X dominant or theory Y dominant. And I think we've touched on it numerous times in this discussion as well about the messy complexity of humans and perhaps even robots in some ways. It's not very straightforward, but it's been really interesting to engage with the primary text and think about it in the context of today. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, I just want to say it's been great to have you on the podcast. I think you've done great on your first episode, and I thought your observations were very trenchant and helped both Tom and I see important aspects that you might have thought about, but you articulated very well. So I do appreciate your insights.
And that concludes episode 59. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us as we discuss another classic work from organization theory or management science, here on Talking About Organizations.